Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio. What could Dr. Ruth, Serena Williams, and Pamela Anderson possibly have in common? They are all subjects of my guest today, documentary filmmaker Ryan White. The Emmy-nominated director takes on a dizzyingly wide range of projects, from the Mars rover to the fight for gay marriage to the unsolved murder of a nun in Baltimore. The most recent project is Pamela, A Love Story. It's a re-examination of 90s bombshell Pamela Anderson and the major events of her life, from her rise to fame to the leak of her stolen sex tape with then-husband Tommy Lee.
I didn't feel like I had a lot of respect.
Did you want to be a serious actress?
I am a serious actress. I had to make a career out of the pieces left. But I'm not the damsel in distress. I put myself in crazy situations. And survived them. I don't care what people think, because it's the only choice I had. If I cared what people think, I wouldn't be here. Some men think, oh, she's the Playboy thing or the sexual person. And they hate you for being something else.
In 2019, the Baywatch star retreated from the spotlight to Vancouver Island, Canada. Much of the film takes place there and features a makeup-free version of the actress, along with personal journals and home video. It's Anderson at her most raw and vulnerable. With White's insight into a different side of Anderson, I wanted to know why he thought she kept up the centerfold persona for so much of her career.
Well, I think she would say that she got stuck in a caricature that she could not break out of. And I think finally with this film coming out, you know, and pulling away at that caricature. But one of the things I love most about Pamela is, you know, you mentioned what could have been, is that Pamela does not spend a lot of the real estate in her mind dedicated to what could have been. She's always looking forward, which makes for a very difficult documentary subject at times, because she doesn't want to reflect a lot on the past or regrets or, you know, some of those heavier things that she went through in her life. She's a very, I always relate Pamela to like a fairy. She's kind of floating through the world and always looking forward. And so I think that's more important to her than anything else. And I don't think she, you know, one of the things I also love about Pamela is she's not incredibly ambitious. She'll be the first to say.
We're done.
Yeah.
Let's change subjects, because you just said it all. She's not very ambitious.
She never really wanted a career that bad. She doesn't love acting. She's an artist, like, which is sort of ironic, because I don't think anyone thinks of, or most people don't think of Pamela Anderson as an artist, but she really does have an artist brain, and she loves the artistic collaboration. So even if she's modeling, say, one of Pamela's best friends is the photographer David LaChapelle, And yes. She told me that, you know, she drives David crazy because she's never interested in seeing the photographs after they take them. And to her, it's because that process of modeling is all about the collaboration with the artist, in that case, David. And that's what she enjoys. And she doesn't really care about the final product. And she was very similar in making this documentary. She didn't care about the documentary product at all. She just enjoyed the hanging out part, the artistic collaboration part.
I feel similarly, not to, you know, intrude with my own life, but it's interesting that I relate to that because it's like someone would say, you want to come watch a cut of the film? And I'd say, no. And to varying degrees, the directors and producers and people would look at me like they were like mildly aghast. They were like, you don't want to watch a cut of the film? And I'm like, well, what do you mean? Are you going to take my notes? So the son approached you. You weren't leaning toward doing a documentary. He pitched you?
He pitched me, and I actually said no thank you at the beginning. You know, I'm born in 1981, so mathematically that means Pamela is like the most famous person in the world as I'm coming of age in my adolescent years in the mid-90s. So I also, like I think a lot of people, came with these preconceived notions about who she would be. And that's, I spend a lot of my time saying no to making celebrity documentaries. And it's because of what I thought Pamela would be, that usually these huge celebrities, especially of her icon status, have a big team of people around them, of agents and managers.
Was it like that with Serena?
No. And that was part of the appeal of making the film about Serena as well. There were a lot of people around Serena, yeah. But Serena is autonomous.
She did the deciding.
Yes, exactly.
So the son pitched you.
He did.
And what convinced you after you were thinking you were leaning toward no? What convinced you?
A Zoom conversation with Pamela is what convinced me. So I had this lunch with Brandon, who's Pamela's son. And I think the subtext that you can't say out loud today when you're hiring people of that lunch was they were looking for a gay documentary director because I think they had tried out other directors and they just weren't the right fit. And most of Pamela's best friends, you know, she doesn't have a lot of people in her inner circle, but most of her best friends are Dan Matthews, David LaChapelle, gay men. So I think Brandon couldn't say that out loud to me.
And do you think, right. And do you think that that's not a calling card? You think that's an advantage you have?
Yeah, I don't know if it's my sexuality necessarily that makes them comfortable, but you know, I also grew up in a house of women, of like a single mom and a grandma and an older sister.
Where did you grow up?
In Georgia, outside of Atlanta.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to college at Duke, which has the Center for Documentary Studies. So wow. I studied all fields of documentary at Duke.
Oh my gosh, so you immersed yourself in that. Did you knew then you wanted to go in that direction?
Yeah, I wanted to be a filmmaker because I loved films growing up. I didn't even know documentaries were a thing. It's not like they were playing, you know, at the Megaplex in Georgia.
Well, we're going to talk about that later, the expansion of documentaries into real programming. So you're there studying, and when you get out, do you go to more education beyond that? You go right to work?
No, I'm like the only one of my friends that didn't go to graduate school. I went straight to work for, you know, 2004 is when I graduated from college, and there weren't a lot of jobs in the documentary space. There Right. were, you know, very few positions to be had. We were known as the broccoli of filmmaking, you know, Right. where you don't want to, but it's good for you. And so I worked for one of the very few filmmakers who was hiring at the time. Her name was Sherry Jones. She actually just passed away last year, but I kind of learned underneath her. She was one of the very few filmmakers who had her own company at the time because it was hard to make a living. And she basically made like frontline-y type PBS documentaries Right. or Bill Moyers specials or Right. Peter Jennings specials. But that was my first job. And I learned under her and I learned how to run a business.
You were in New York?
It was in Washington, D.C., actually.
Wow.
But New York really was the hub at the time. It's moved a lot over to Los Angeles since I've been in my career. But yeah, that was where I kind of cut my teeth, was under Sherry Jones.
What is the movie Pallada? Your first film was called Pallada?
It was. It's a documentary about pickup soccer, street soccer all over the world that we filmed in 25 countries, which is totally absurd. Like the only the type of film that you would think you can pull off at 25 years old. That if a 25-year-old were coming to me now, that I would say that's insane. You know,
I can see that
pitch
when you're trying to raise money. You're like, I'm going to do a movie about soccer. And they're like, well, where is it set? And you go, everywhere.
Everywhere.
I'm going to go everywhere that soccer is and make a movie about it. So after you do that, what's the first movie you do whether it's a pitch from you or someone's commissioning you or approaching, what's the first movie you have where you got a real budget? Who was it for?
It was my third film. It was for HBO, where Sheila Nevins was the head of HBO at the time, and she is, you know, the godmother of
we
American
had her on
documentaries.
The show, yeah.
Oh, you did? She's the best. Yeah, it felt like I had gotten the golden ticket when Sheila bought my film. I made a film about gay marriage that came out, I think, 2014, but I started making it.
Case Against AIDS.
Case Against AIDS. So it was about Proposition 8, which passed in 2008 when Obama was elected.
So Case Against AIDS has great resonance for you. You're at Sundance, you're nominated for 2 Emmys, is that correct?
Yes.
And you're shortlisted for the Oscar.
Yes.
So everything, I'm assuming, changes after that.
It did, and also the documentary landscape was changing after that. That was like the year that Netflix was emerging, and streamers, you know, were kind of a glimmer in our eye at that point. But the real changing factor for me, Case Against AIDS was very successful critically, but I followed that up with a documentary series for Netflix called The Keepers, which was about the murder of a nun in Baltimore, but basically cover-ups of the Catholic Church, which is, you know, no revolutionary story, but it was in the era of Netflix where there just wasn't the overabundance of content. It was the follow-up to Making a Murder. It was the next true crime series on Netflix after that. So there was such a huge captive audience. So the amount of people that tuned in for The Keepers was mind-blowing for me as a documentary filmmaker.
Mm-hmm. Eventually, you get to the point where you start doing these biographical ones. You do Dr. Ruth West. Is that your first one, Dr. Ruth?
I think I did Serena before Dr. Ruth.
Oh, you did Serena before. So let's talk about that. So Serena, I would imagine that someone who is as, I always have a different metric, which is not just successful and monolithic in their career, but they deserve it. She's earned everything that's come her way. I mean, I was there at the U.S. Open when she freaked out on the judge. I was there in the president's box. Did you find that, the yin and yang of the intensity? Because athletes are people who have to turn on a level of aggression you and I can't even imagine, and then turn it off.
Exactly. But she could turn that on playing cards with you as well, or charades. So that's in Serena's DNA in a way that I've never seen before. You know, I'm the exact same age as Serena. She's, I think, a couple weeks younger than me. So being around her was so fascinating because she was so youthful. I think there's some arrested development when you get really famous and successful at something when you're a teenager. And so Serena has this infectious spirit, unless she's playing a game, and tennis included, that's like, she is one of the most fun people to be around outside of a tennis court. And so, yeah, that there is a switch in her. And even, you know, even in practicing tennis, she was so intense.
Who brokered that production? You pitched them, or they came to you?
Well, that was interesting because that was before the documentary heyday. And, you know, I hate even talking about this documentary because it's literally unavailable now. We talk about the shifting landscape of documentary. It was made by Epix, and Epix had a license at some point, which lapsed. And now there's actually no way to watch that documentary.
To see the Serena doc?
Yeah, unless I send you a Vimeo link. It's currently not on any of the streamers.
Why is that?
It's because the license lapsed and it didn't go to one of the streamers. So, I mean, I love Serena and I love tennis. So it's probably one of my favorite films. I think I've made 15, and I got to be there during the craziest year of Serena's life. And she let me, the craziest year of her career, at least. And she let me film everything.
Craziest why?
Because it was the best year of her career. And then it ended in the biggest failure. That was the year that she won the first 3 Grand Slams, was at the U.S. Open. The field had totally opened up. She just had to beat 2 kind of unseeded, no-name Italian women to win the calendar slam. It was going to be the first calendar slam in 30
Since
years.
Since Labor. Who knows?
Yeah, and she lost in the semifinal to Roberta Vinci. I was there on the court with her filming, and it was the biggest, you know, there's a part in my film where I'm just in bed with her afterwards and she's talking about being such an embarrassment to the entire country. And so to me, that film is incredibly special because I had never seen an athlete of her stature let a filmmaker that close to the process and be that vulnerable.
To the pain.
The pain and the ups and the downs. And, you know, that's where I think Serena is. Serena, Dr. Ruth, and Pamela, I consider very similar, even though it's totally different fields.
Only you could make a statement like that. How so?
Well, they're great documentary subjects in the sense that they've all been through, they've been, you know, chewed up and spit out by society. Pamela and Serena more so than Dr. Ruth, I think, but they don't really care that much how they're perceived because they've had the worst thing said about them. And so they're very unashamed about who they are. And so that, like, when you have a non-controlling documentary subject who's just allowing you to be everywhere, which both Serena and Pamela did, that's where the really good stuff comes from, I think. As opposed to when you have agents and managers and publicists circling that's you death. And yeah. saying, don't say this, don't say that. If Serena's yeah. told that, she would say, I'm going to say what I want to say.
Now, I would imagine that we'll just use these two examples of how peripatetic the Serena Williamses of the world are, traveling the world everywhere, go, 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 tournament, tennis, appearances, whatever her whole bouquet is of activities. And there's Pamela sitting by the river. You know what I mean? Did you have to chase Serena around the world to film her?
Yeah. I mean, I basically made that film myself because I didn't have a crew
yeah.
because Serena is so on the go. You know, you can't with a sound person and yeah, a camera person jump in a car with Serena or on a private plane. Yeah. So that movie is just basically me with my camera alongside Serena the whole way. Pamela's actually quite similar. Like, you would think the bigger the documentary subject or the bigger the fame, that the bigger the crew would be or the more overproduced the celebrity would want it to be. One of the things I loved about Pamela from the beginning when we had initial conversations like that Zoom, she wanted to do something totally stripped down and bare bones. Pamela hates watching celebrity documentaries, and I hate them too, to be honest, like the overproduced ones that feel like these glossy, you know, one interview portraits. And so we did that film very, very stripped down, small crew, no lights at all. You know, I remember asking Brandon, her son, like, what do we need for a hair and makeup budget? And like, how do we deal with that in Vancouver Island? And he burst into laughter and said, like, yeah. my mom's going to do her own hair and makeup. She yeah. has her entire career. And so she constantly challenged those preconceived notions I had of her of probably being, you know, this larger than life, perhaps more difficult personality. And she was incredibly easy to work with in that way.
Director Ryan White. If you enjoy conversations with insightful documentary directors, check out my episode with the most recent winner of the Academy Award for Feature Documentary, Daniel Rohrer.
You asked quite a pointed question, and that's whether or not Alexei actually has a reasonable chance of ever becoming president. And what he spoke to was the Moscow mayoral race of 2013. He started that race with 2% of the vote. People didn't like him. They caricatured him as just a blogger and some wacky internet guy. And he finished with 27% of the vote. It wasn't a fair election. There was malfeasance. And I think the Kremlin, who let him run in that election, was so nervous about his performance. He ran an American-style campaign. He was kissing babies, knocking on doors, in the subways, distributing literature, tens of thousands of volunteers. There has never been a political organization in Russia like that. They were afraid. I don't know if the guy will be president, but what I hope at the very least is that he will have the chance to compete in a democratic election.
To hear more of my conversation with Navalny director Daniel Rohrer, go to heresthething.org. After the break, Ryan White speculates on the impact that filming the documentary had on Pamela Anderson's life.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule.
Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. One of the themes of documentary filmmaker Ryan White's Pamela, A Love Story is the roller coaster of Pamela Anderson's love life. The film examines her relationships with rockers Tommy Lee and Kid Rock and her most recent brief marriage to contractor Dan Hayhurst, the fifth for the actress. I wanted to know what Ryan White discovered about Anderson's search for true love from working on the film.
She's always looking for something, a spark, and that spark is often combustible, as it was with Tommy. And I think it's a spark, it's too combustible, and she knows that. It's the type of relationship that is unsustainable because there's too much passion at the center of it. But that's always what she's seeking out. But I'm curious, like, watching the film, though, did you, because for me, as someone who got to inherit all Pamela's archive and get to watch all of these tapes, and the, you know, the stolen sex tape has gone down in infamy, but getting to watch all these other tapes that they had shot of each other, and I hope the film does this in some ways, I hope it also strips the caricature of Tommy a little bit, where he's a human being, and when you watch the tapes of, you know, them just falling in love or starting a family or once they have kids, I think that passed out rocker fades away a little bit and you get to see the real him.
I was never quite sure with them what was real and what was them just performing. You know what I mean? Like you can tell that, I mean, I think one of the most tragic things, because the sex tape thing, you know, the Kardashian empire, which is now calculated in the billions of dollars, is founded on a sex tape. Let's not kid ourselves. Then you tell the story of the safe. They never found out who did it, did they?
Well, there's theories about who did it, and there's a whole Hulu show about some of those theories, but we actually have a line in the film that Pamela says where she says, I don't care who stole it. I don't need to figure that out at this point, and I think that's incredibly unimportant to her, the who. It's just, it did what it did to her life, and the who is not that important to her.
Well, then that leads me to when she meets a solid citizen, she marries that guy. Who's the guy that lives up there near her? What was his name?
Dan.
And that didn't work. You think, why? That didn't last. Why?
Well, this is an interesting example. You know, you learn in film school or like documentary 101 that your job as a filmmaker is to not affect the person's trajectory in any way. You know, you hear these terms like cinema verite or fly on the wall. This was a glaring example of the films that I've made where the mere fact that I was making a movie changed. It stirred something up in Pamela that even the very first shoot I had with her in Canada, that's when she's watching those tapes of her and Tommy's life, basically, and she's just plugging them into the VCR and watching. She was going through this emotional turmoil. She had never watched those tapes, and she's looking at me saying, like, what the fuck am I doing here? I thought I was coming here to die. I was marrying a local. I thought this was going to be the end of my life, and I'm watching the best years of my life. You know, I think she's self-aware enough to know that she's seeing that through rose-tinted glasses now, and that even, you know, watching those things in retrospect, she's overlooking a lot of the darkness that was during those years. But it stirred something up in her where, you know, I don't want to say the film caused a divorce, but it definitely precipitated her in saying, like, this is not the final 30 years of my life. I need to get out of here.
Right. So she doesn't like to watch the movie. She doesn't like to see the movie. Did her son watch the movie, I assume?
So Brandon produced the movie. Right. So he watched cuts as we went along.
Did he have any editorial control?
No.
Did he seek any editorial control?
No. And he gave me notes, but they were actually good notes. This is the benefit of usually producing a film with the son of the subject would be a nightmare.
Sure.
And I thought this might be a nightmare. I knew that was going to be kind of rolling the dice. But it's also the benefit of making a film about the child of a couple who've been the center of the tabloids for 30 years is they just don't really care. So the things I thought he would be really sensitive about, like his mom maybe, well, nudity for sure, but also his mom maybe saying an inappropriate thing here or there or joking about other husbands or her sex life, Brandon was fine with all of that. So yeah, no, he didn't change. I'm very lucky as a filmmaker. I haven't had a bad experience yet with a distributor or any producers ever not letting me make what I want to make. And Ben Pamela herself was just so uninterested. So she did watch it once after the film was finished. And I think she only kind of half watched it because even when I talk to her now, she still doesn't realize some of the things that are in the film. And she watched it with her son, Dylan, at Netflix while the film was already coming out and she was doing press. And Brandon said, like, Mom, you're answering these questions in such weird ways because you don't know what's in the film. Will you just watch it? And Dylan hadn't seen it yet either because Dylan wasn't a producer. So they watched it together in a little room at Netflix. Netflix asked me if I wanted to be there and I said, hell no. And apparently it was just, well, first of all, there's a lot of nudity in the film. So it was a lot of Pamela covering Dylan's eyes is what I've heard from people in the room. And she took a few bathroom breaks even while the film kept playing. So she still, you know, like you see in the film, she gave me every single diary from her entire life. I have them in a closet with a coded lock on them. And she had no idea what I was going to use, how I was going to use it. And she still, because she's only half watched the film, doesn't really.
David Nugent and I produced the summer documentary program for in East Hampton. And let's say going back to 15 years ago, they would fire the starter's pistol at Sundance. The latest crop of the more exciting docs was announced and screened at Sundance. And then we had a relatively easy time booking three, sometimes four of them. But now, if there's 12 we have our eye on, good God, we consider ourselves lucky if we can get two or three of them. They're all just selling like hotcakes. Do you find that explosion as a part of your career as well?
Yeah, I mean, and that's a lot of people talk about Sundance now and the lack of truly independent films because so many documentaries over the last few years that have gotten into Sundance had distribution already, even if it's not super public. Like I've had films, I think I've had four films at Sundance, and there's been times I've been at Sundance where you don't know my film has a distributor attached. It might seem like a free agent, but it's not.
Right.
And I think Sundance is doing a good job of moving back a little bit more to independent filmmakers. Not that I'm thrilled about that, because usually my films do come with distribution at this point in my career.
Sure.
So I don't want it to get harder to get into Sundance just because I have a Netflix or an Amazon behind me. But I think we're seeing like an ebb and flow in the documentary industry. And I don't want to get too nitty gritty, but like recently we've seen a lot of documentary units shut down, like at HBO Max, CNN Films, Showtime.
CNN Films shut down?
Yeah.
Wow.
And they just made Navalny, which won the Oscar. And so the documentary part of CNN Films is shutting down. And so we're also seeing this constriction that, at least for people in my world, is a little concerning because, you know, like back when I made The Case Against Age, Sheila Nevins, like that was the golden ticket, like I said, but that was one of the only distributors at the time, unless you went the theatrical route, where your film got a lot of attention because Sheila was so powerful at HBO. And then there was, you know, the birth of all of the streamers, which was incredible for the last 10 years. But now we're seeing that shrink again. So I don't know, Annie, or especially I'm interested to hear you say it's hard for you guys to even get three or four films, because I think what we're seeing now is a lot of the political films or hard hitting films are a harder sell. Like the things that Sheila would have taken on at HBO 10 or 15 years ago, those are often the ones. Assassins is a great example.
Yeah, we're gonna talk
about
that
was one of the very few films where I eked out a sale of that film. I almost lost a lot of money making that film, not because people didn't love it. All the distributors loved it, but they were afraid of it.
They were afraid why?
Because it was about North Korea, because of the Sony hack. No one wanted to touch a film that was going after Kim Jong-un. No one wanted to go after a film. Geopolitics are really difficult right now.
Yeah. Director Ryan White, if you're enjoying this conversation, tell a friend. And be sure to follow Here's the Thing on the iHeartRadio app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, Ryan White shares the movie that inspired him to become a documentary filmmaker.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Director Ryan White helmed one of my favorite documentaries of all time, Assassins. It traces the murder of Kim Jong-un's half-brother Kim Jong-nam and the subsequent trial of his killers. The film needs to be seen to be believed. Considering the near total lack of diplomatic relations with North Korea, I wanted to know how White managed to pull off a film with such a challenging subject matter.
I came across it because I went to Duke, and a journalist who had gone to Duke, who was much younger than me, had written an article in GQ magazine that had been very popular in whatever year that was, like 2018. And he approached me because he was getting a ton of documentary interest, because true crime was, in 2018, 2019, was huge. And this was like true crime on steroids. It involved Kim Jong-un. It involved a prank show. It involved female assassins. It involved a capital punishment trial that was happening. And so I flew with the journalist to Malaysia where this trial was happening and met all of his sources, basically, all of the people who had played a role in recruiting these women to be on the so-called prank show. Because the women were saying, yes, we assassinated this man, but we thought we were on a prank show.
Yes.
when we did the assassination. It's unbelievable. It's literally unbelievable. But as we started peeling back the layers, we started and meeting the people who were a part of recruiting them, it seemed, I don't know about believable, but it seemed conceivable at least that maybe they were telling the truth. And then it became a film that was about life or death. Like, I knew I was making a film that would probably prove that these women were innocent, but if I didn't finish the film in time, I needed the film ready to go in case they were convicted, because they were going to be hung almost immediately in the Malaysian court system. So it was a very heavy film to make, and not to ruin the ending, but luckily both women got off at like the 11th hour. You know, like I said, I thought I had struck gold with that film because it was true crime, but it was on a geopolitical level. I thought,
who distributed that?
In the end, it was a company called Greenwich.
So no streamers?
No streamers.
Where can you find it now?
I think it's on Stars, but none of the streamers would even put it on their platform, much less make it, you know, an original.
I want it on DVD.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah, it was a film that nobody wanted to touch. And unfortunately, I learned a lot of lessons from making that film on how you...
For example?
Well, like in Navalny, for instance, Daniel pulled off something very brave and incredible, but now that distributor doesn't exist anymore. I don't know where you would take a Navalny now. So touching, you know, North Korea, Russia, China, these countries, it's more and more difficult. You can make those films, but are they going to find a home? Are they going? And if they can't find a home, are they going to find an audience? And knowing that we all spend at least a couple years, if not 5 or 6 years, making our films, to think that they'll just, you know, be a tree falling in the forest, I think is all of our worst nightmares as filmmakers.
Yeah. Well, it's also, like you said, you're right, the arc of that film is kind of a specific, which is it goes from being like mysterious, you don't know what's going on here, to being downright silly, to being like crushing at the end. Like you really think they're going to, I mean, I was really thinking if I stopped the film and said, okay, everybody, let's bet what happens, I would have bet they were going to be killed.
That's what everyone was telling us. Everybody on the ground was saying they're going to die.
Now, have you only shot digital your entire career? Did you ever shoot film?
We shot some film with Pamela, actually, ironically. So my last film, I shot some film, but I've never shot a full document, like a Gimme Shelter type of
film. And you don't
film,
care.
Fully on film. Oh, I would love to, but the budgets don't support it. Also, my style of filmmaking doesn't really support it. Like, I can't, jumping on a private plane with Serena with my little camera, I can't do that.
With tons
film.
Of mags, yeah.
Yeah, and I shoot a ton, you know, and so do most of my colleagues at this point.
For you, I'm sure there's a lot of films that you're considering. You probably got a lot of pots on the stove. Have you ever examined the subject and you thought you were going to make the movie and then you cut out? You didn't do it.
Only one time, and I still feel incredibly guilty about it.
Can you say it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a long time ago. It was early in my career, but I started making a very Aaron Brockovich type of story about a community that had been built on top of an old Shell oil reservoir, basically. And it's your dime a dozen environmental terrorism story. And it's, you know, people getting cancer and not realizing why. And then they realize they're living on top of an oil field. And it was such a bleak subject matter.
What part of the country?
It was near LA in Carson, California, just south of LA. And it was just such a bleak subject matter. I couldn't raise any money to do it. And I'd started shooting it. And then I had to go to all these people that were my characters and say, like, I'm bowing out. And I still, like, even saying that, I hate saying it out loud right now because I still feel very guilty about it. But I'm very careful now in picking documentaries. You know, I can only make maybe two things at the same time. Yeah. I'm very careful at picking things that I think will make it to the finish line.
What are you working on next?
I'm doing a return to true crime. I'm actually working with Charlize Theron on a film about an incredible story about a mother who gave up her daughter for adoption and then 20 years later finds out that her daughter went missing when she was young. And she goes on this quest to find out what happened to her daughter. And in that, kind of uncovers a serial killer who was living in a small town. I really resisted going back to true crime after The Keepers was such a phenomenon and didn't want to be pigeonholed in that way. But this is the type of true crime that I love, where there's an incredible character at the center of it. And Charlize brought us the project and is very passionate about it. And I'm always trying to balance, you know, I made a film last year called Goodnight Oppie about a robot that went to Mars, and it is very hopeful, very heartwarming. It's really about the best parts of humanity. And I'm always trying to kind of balance, you know, subjects that are quite dark and bleak and make me feel afraid when I'm out there in the field, like an assassin's, with something that is much more fun and hopeful and can kind of bring me and my crew, because I roll the same people over, my editors, my producers on the same films, that can kind of bring us out of that darkness in a sort of yin and yang way.
Yeah, no, Assassins is one of my favorites. I really mean that. It's amazing.
Thank you. Well, you were one of the few.
When you see the moment where they get him at the airport, where they do it to him, the real moment when they do it to him, you're kind of like, you just gasp. You're like, there it is. You know, they really did this to him. Now, last question is, because I'm such a doc junkie, and I'm assuming you are too, give me three docs that just were indelible in your movie-going history.
I mean, I could give you dozens, but I'll anecdotally, like, the film that made me a documentary filmmaker, do you know Agnès Varda, the French filmmaker who passed away recently? She, to me, is like, she's my ultimate, like, if I could have dinner with someone, it would be her. And that's what's cool about my industry, is you are within arm's length of your hero. So I got to meet her many times before she passed away. But it was seeing her film in a theater at Duke when I didn't even know what documentaries were. It was the film called The Gleaners and I. Well, it has a French title, but that's the English translation, that just blew my mind and made me want to be a documentary filmmaker. And in those same years, Spellbound came out, the Jeff Blitz's film about the spelling bee, which totally changed my conception again of the broccoli of filmmaking, that you don't want to do it, but it's good for you, where Spellbound was pure entertainment.
Right.
A hilarious film, a character portrait of many kids during that year's script spelling bee. So that one changed my conception that I couldn't make things that are entertaining, which really is my goal as a documentary filmmaker. filmmaker. I'm not an activist filmmaker. I don't really make thematic films. I mostly focus on character films, even if it's about a robot, that I hope will entertain people by going on this journey. And then Laura Poitras, I don't know if you've met her, but like I could go on and on about a lot of her films. You know, her film this year was All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, which was beautiful. But I remember seeing a film of hers soon after I graduated when I was very young in the documentary business called The Oath. And that is such a beautiful film. And you can tell in all of Laura's films how hands-on of a filmmaker she is. And that's what I strive to do as a filmmaker. Like I said, not huge crews. I think the smaller we are, the more intimate it is and the better performance, and I'm using that in quotation marks, you get out of your documentary subject, even if they're as famous as Serena Williams or Pamela Anderson, the more stripped down you are, I think the better results you get. And Laura Poitras, I feel like, she made the Edward Snowden film, you know, where she's in hotel rooms with him as he's fleeing. And so I think she really taught me in her films a lot of that sort of DIY feel, which I really love. No matter how successful or how big our budgets get, I still love making films in that DIY. I'm just carrying a camera, you know, and in a room with sometimes just me with that person.
It lends itself to documentary filmmaking in its purest sense more easily. If you got a bunch of guys setting up a bunch of C-stands and you got a lot of shit going on.
Exactly.
It's tricky. But anyway, my very best to you. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I appreciate it. I enjoyed the conversation.
My thanks to documentary filmmaker Ryan White. This episode was recorded at CDM Studios in New York City. We're produced by Kathleen Russo, Zach McNeese, and Maureen Hoban. Our engineer is Frank Imperial. Our social media manager is Danielle Gingrich. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is brought to you by iHeart Radio.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.